going to be talking this morning to a number of people. Augie Roberts is with us, Dominic Lucchesi. I understand that Yona may join us for a period of time, and Ben Isquith, the cybernetician. And we've had so many letters and cards from people telling us that they'd like to know more about the Darrells. Now, some people believe in Darrells, some people don't. We've had people that tell us it's science fiction. Other people tell us that this is true. I don't know, frankly. I'm sort of a non-believer. But we'll find out this morning, or at least we'll ask a number of questions, and I hope that we'll be able to get a number of answers. And if I'm correct, I think that the beginning of the famous Darrow story, or the Shaver Mysteries, was... Actually, this was started by Ray Palmer, isn't that true?
Yes, it was started while Ray Palmer was the editor of Amazing Stories. Ray Palmer was the editor of Amazing Stories for 12 years, and during this time, Palmer did run the series, which were written by Richard S. Shaver, but which Palmer admitted he padded in order to make it more interesting for the readers of Amazing Stories. Now, that original story, which really created the whole Shaver mystery, so to speak, was a story called I Remember Lemuria, which was written in 1945. And right after that story hit the stands and people began to read the magazine, it began to get circulated around, and the next month, 50,000 letters were received by W.B. Ziff, who was the publisher at the time. And that was after the first printing of the story, John. Now, Shaver wrote these thought records, as he called them, later on. And I'll explain just how that came about.
Well, I'm trying to figure, how can you write a thought record?
Well, Shaver claimed that he was receiving messages. Now, actually,
I thought when you said a record, I was thinking in terms of a disc on a turntable.
Yes, it may be something like that, John. Actually, we don't know just what these mechanisms in the caverns look like. Shaver claimed that actually the history of these race of beings who resided on the Earth 20,000 years ago was on a thought record and being transmitted to him by a mechanism in one of the caverns. And when I say that, I have to go into detail there.
Well, was Shaver in the cavern? Is this where he saw this equipment?
A little later on, he claims to have had some type of...
In other words, I'm rushing you?
Yeah, more or less, John.
You continue, I'm sorry.
Because so we'd have to get down to the bottom of this. He was working as
a welder. The bottom of the cavern?
Well, I'd like to, certainly, but... And I think I know just about how to go about it, but it wouldn't be... wouldn't be proper to state it, because many people could get into grave danger attempting to enter the caverns. Now, Shaver worked as a welder for a shipyard, and he claimed that these thought records were being received by him while he was welding. Now, whether the welding arc had anything to do with the pickup of these records, which were transmitted through the Earth's shell, so to speak, from the caverns, I don't know. But he claimed that these messages, he began to hear these voices, sort of a super ESP. Now, of course, ESP, if advanced by a welder, isn't credited as much as when it's advanced by someone like Dr. Ryan or some more qualified individual. But I think that maybe it could be, the possibility exists that Shaver actually was receiving some type of information by ESP, I don't know. And yet, as the mystery unfolded, during the period of years that Amazing Stories published it, there were some things that Shaver said and stated and predicted, more or less, which actually seemed as though he was receiving some form of information from some outer source, so to speak. Because from what I can gather from Ray himself, Ray Palmer, is that Palmer claims that Shaver used to send these manuscripts into him, and he would have to edit them. And these manuscripts were written on the backs of envelopes, scrap paper. In other words, they weren't in proper form for submission to any publication.
What was there a reason for this? Was Mr. Shaver a poor man and couldn't afford to have...
I don't think so, John. I think that he was just a little odd, we may say, in his way of writing. He probably wrote when he received these so-called messages.
In other words, he would find an envelope in his pocket and use
More or less, that's the way it appeared, anyway.
A business card, anything.
Let's put it this way. That's the way Shaver made it appear, anyway. And I don't know whether he did it because he didn't have paper or he couldn't afford it. But that is the way Palmer claims he used to receive these manuscripts. Now, Shaver sent these manuscripts in a condensed form, and he sent them into Amazing Stories as truth. Now, Amazing Stories...
If I may interrupt you, did Amazing Stories up to that time ever print a nonfiction story?
No, well, strangely enough, John, before I remember Lemuria was published in Amazing Stories, Shaver, I believe, did submit a small sort of a two-page deal which dealt with an alphabet which he claimed to have received or have possession of.
Shaver received this
alphabet, and that was printed in 1943, from what I can gather, mm-hmm. which was before the story I Remember Lemuria. And according to Palmer, after this story I Remember Lemuria was published, these 50,000 letters, it's very difficult to believe, of course, but Palmer claims that all these 50,000 letters were more or less what we may term positive letters, few negative letters.
Let me ask you this, Dominic. I understand that the circulation for that particular month was only 50,000. Is that true? Or was it an additional 50,000?
Well, I know... the circulation went up to 185,000 copies per month, and it netted the publication about $500,000. So,
that's neither here nor there about the amount of money. I was interested in the circulation. You say that the circulation was about 185,000.
After these stories began to be published.
Well, then there is a possibility that... they could receive 50,000 letters. Let's just say that the circulation was actually 150,000 for round figures. And that would be a third of the readers that sent in a letter. Of course, that would be a tremendous amount. I mean, that's very unusual. But let's face it, if we're going to accept that circulation figure, and I have no reason to doubt the word of Ziff Davis... as a publishing outfit, and if they had that amount of circulation, well, they could have received 50,000 letters.
Well, I'd like to qualify that one particular statement, John. It wasn't Ziff Davis that made this claim. It was Palmer himself that made this claim.
Well, now, let me ask you this, Dominic. Are you familiar with ABC, Audit Bureau of Circulation? That's an unbiased organization that determines the circulation of any publication that is a member of their organization. Now, you can't pay them off. In other words, no money would ever... you couldn't even offer them enough money at any time that maybe they would try to give you a break and add a little additional circulation to their report. Now, Ziff Davis, I'm very sure, I don't know about that in those days, but Ziff Davis, I'm very sure... is a member of the Audit Bureau of Circulation. So any circulation figure that would be given out by the Ziff Davis publishers or any member of Audit Bureau of Circulation would be an accurate circulation figure. Now, if this figure was given out, that figure of 185,000 by the Ziff Davis publishers, then you and I can bet our bottom dollar that that was the legitimate paid circulation. There is no exaggeration. There's no cream that's been put on top or anything to puff it up.
Well, that's a fantastic circulation for a magazine of that type at the time, John.
I wouldn't be in a position to judge. I don't know what would be considered good circulation for a science fiction publication. I might just say this to you, that I understand that Life has a circulation of, I think... something like $6 or $7 million. I know that Fate magazine has a circulation of 65,000. And certainly that's a magazine that, it's directed to a very, very limited group of readers. So it's quite possible that they had that. I mean, I think we should at least be fair to Palmer and to Ziff Davis and to Mr. Shaver and say that this is quite possible. And if they had 185,000 readers that month, or if they had 185,000 paid circulation, then there is a possibility, as remote as it may seem, that they could receive 50,000 letters.
Yeah, well, from what I hear, John, is that there was a paper shortage at the time, and as the circulation began to increase and began to get at these large figures, they began taking paper from their other magazines in order to keep up the quantity of amazing stories.
In other words, they had, I think, a detective publication at the time, and they would borrow paper, so they would publish less of one publication and put out more copies of amazing stories.
Yeah, that's what I heard, John. And I can believe it.
Let me ask you this. Did you hear this from Palmer, or is this known in the trade?
Well, this is sort of known in the trade. I mean, this is sort of a trade rumor, so to speak. And I myself know that at the time I was very extremely interested in Shaver and in Palmer, of course, because I did like amazing stories. I like to read them as science fiction, and I found that they became extremely fascinating as propounding the Shaver mystery and sort of putting it over as truth. And I myself used to have trouble sometimes finding a newsstand which had the magazine about 4 or 5 days after it hit. It seemed like just
during the war.
During the time when the Shaver mystery was running more or less every month.
But was that during the war?
Yes, that was during the war. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was just near the end of the war. Actually, it really started in 1945 when he hit with that one terrific story there, I Remember Lemuria. And that seemed to have keyed everybody off. But people began writing in and saying, it's true, this thing happened to me and it's happened to my neighbor, and Shaver is telling the truth. And they began backing him up right up to the hilt, 100%.
Well, an interesting thought, at least I think it's rather interesting to think about for a moment. I was always under the impression that the majority of people who purchased or did purchase at that time Amazing Stories, that these were science fiction fans. Now, do you think that science fiction fans would be the type who would write in letters and say, I believe this happened to me and all? Because they're so accustomed to these wild, fantastic tales that they've been reading the magazine for any length of time.
Well, John, I don't really know, because I noticed that after this story came out, whether word got around or whether it was the cover or whatever it was, but I noticed many of my friends who weren't interested in science fiction began buying Amazing Stories. And in all probability, some of the science fiction fans, and I can't say percentage-wise or to what degree, but I'd say some of the science fiction fans did buy the Shaver story, besides buying Amazing Stories.
Wasn't it also true, Dom, that there were Shaver clubs at that time, and many people would tell others?
There were Shaver mystery clubs started, and they were more or less, we could liken them to the saucer clubs of today. And the strangest thing is that Shaver, in his original stories, explained what people call the saucer mystery today. Actually, Shaver had it long before the so-called saucer mystery ever came into the headlines.
Well, he was the one that put some pretty good saucer stories out.
Who, Shaver?
Shaver did.
They weren't exactly saucer stories.
Well, he didn't call them saucers, though.
No, he had a different name for them. And he was using a lot of, if you took notice in his writings, but I don't know whether it was Shaver's touch or whether it was Palmer's touch, which gave it that sort of ancient Hindu mythological angle, sort of. And they were terrific stories. They were I wouldn't say they were the best in science fiction, by no means. But it was the footnotes to the stories which made them interesting. In other words, Palmer would probably expand one paragraph of Shaver's into two pages of script in the magazine. And then below this, he would more or less try and reclaim what were the supposed truths hidden in Palmer's rendition of Shaver's so-called thought record receptions.
I've been listening, but I may have missed the point. Did you bring out, or did I hear this someplace else, about the fact that Mr. Shaver was receiving these messages through some type of welding equipment?
Yes, he was, John.
Did you bring this up
yes,
yet?
Yes, John.
I see. Well, then, where do we come in with the thought records?
Well, the information that Shaver received on this welding equipment was information which pertained to the history of what we may say of life on the Earth itself, on this planet. And these records supposedly went back 20,000 years into history, the history of the planet. Of this planet, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of was getting this record, which was a recording left behind by the race of beings who inhabited the planet before the present era. These beings were known as Titans, Shaver claims, and later on in some of his stories and some of the thought records, they come out as Atlans, A-T-L-A-N-S, which would give us to presuppose that there was sort of an Atlantis theme involved in Shaver's history.
Did he ever mention anything about Atlantis?
Well, he claimed that the continent of Atlantis and Lemuria, or Mu, as it was known, did exist and was part of the ancient inhabited colonies of these Titans. But one thing Shaver did say, and that was that Atlantis did not necessarily sink. In other words, it did not go beneath the sea, as we have come to more or less suppose. But actually, the sinking was a misinterpretation.
What happened to it then, according to Shaver?
Well, Shaver claims that the Atlantis, or I can't recall exactly which one now. It was a long time ago that I read this particular...
I thought you were going to claim that you were there at the time, but go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I might be a reincarnated Dero or Tiro.
Is it Dero or Daryl?
Well, I don't know. I guess you could use sort of a freehand style on it.
Well, who has determined this?
Actually, according to Mantung alphabet, D-E...
According to what?
Mantung, the alphabet.
Oh,
which
sure.
Supposedly Shaver received from these thought records of Lemuria, was D-E. So D-E would be pronounced in that alphabet as D. So, and Rho. Rho,
So it's
D-Rho.
Because
R stood for, in the alphabet, it was a phonetic alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And as Shaver claimed, this alphabet, each letter in the alphabet was descriptive of a particular mental concept or sequence of mental concepts. It was sort of a basic source alphabet for the human language.
So what would D be?
D would be disintegrant energy, and it would be pronounced D-E.
And what would R-O be? Or
R would be horror. And O stood for orifice or source. So D Rho would stand for detrimental horror source. And in other words, detrimental Rho or detrimental robot, if we convert it into modern English. Shaver claims that this alphabet works out in most languages except the Romance languages. He claims that it doesn't work out so well in the Romance languages. But it does work well. It works in the ancient Teutonic dialects. It works well in Sanskrit. It works out in Hindustan, I believe the language.
Have you ever made any tests?
Yes, I have, John. And a little later in the program, I would like to conduct a test with your permission.
With the listeners, you mean?
With the listeners, John.
Fine. All right. Now, when I interrupted you, Dominic, I think that you were telling me the correct pronunciation of the word D-E-R-O.
That's right, John. But we have to remember that there isn't only D-Ro, there's also T-Ro, supposedly living in these caverns. And there's another thing we have to consider. When we say caverns beneath the earth, they don't necessarily have to be below sea level, actually, because as Shaver claimed, many of the mountain ranges, which are above sea level, contain these vast caverns which run for thousands of miles beneath the earth. And we, of course, do realize that there are many unexplored areas of the earth which consist of thousands and thousands of square miles. I'd even go as far as to say there's also some part of the globe which hasn't even been flown over. And I think you should know something about that, Augie. What do you think about,
The caves?
Unexplored areas on the surface?
There are many, many places, I believe, Dom, that have never been explored before. In fact, even in our own United States here. Of course, the Tibet and all those places haven't been explored too well.
Well, yes, Himalayas is a very unknown, more or less unknown territory.
I was just wondering, Dominic, if you could tell our listeners, because there's a possibility that some of them didn't hear the discussion, the time that we had Jack Robinson, is that his name?
Yes, Jack was here that evening.
Can
and,
you tell, can you sort of give us a little recap on that, what happened to him?
Well, John, I wouldn't try to attempt to emulate Jack, because Jack actually lived the story. He was part of it. And I'll do my best to recall it. Of course, I would never be able to tell it quite as convincingly as Jack does, because he is the man it happened to. He is the man that knew this person. I can't recall that person's name now. Do you recall it, Augie?
I don't remember it, Don.
Well, Jack was living in a furnished room at the time, I believe. And there was this artist whom Jack became acquainted with. And Jack claims that this fellow had a strange hobby, if I recall correctly, of creating jewelry out of buttons, was it, Augie?
Well, jewelry out of buttons, he did.
He collected buttons, and then he used to put little pins on them, and fancy mm-hmm. buttons, and put little pins on them, and created this sort of a costume jewelry. And Jack got to know him very well. He gained the man's confidence. And this man claimed, well, he told Jack this in more or less over a period of time. Jack was able to derive from the man the fact that this man at one time or another had been on a prospecting trip into the desert country in California, and this man claimed that he was kidnapped by the Dero, and that he had been kept in the caverns for, I forget how many years
it was. I believe it was 2 years, Don.
2 years, was it, Augie? And that in some way, I can't remember the exact details, but the man found himself wandering in New York City here, wasn't it, Augie?
Wasn't there some story about that he was missing, he had on jeans or something.
Yes,
he had $100 in his pocket, and 2 years later, he found himself walking on Times Square with the same garments on, the same $800, and it seemed that no time had lapsed, and yet he discovered that it was 2 years later, that 2 years out of his life seemed to have disappeared, and he had no knowledge of it.
That was the idea of it, John, and plus the fact that the man was an artist, if I remember, and the man used to paint these very weird landscapes, which looked like landscapes from another world. They consisted of odd color combinations in color and harmonious tone. The paintings, he said, had a great depth to them. And they had this very weird quality that no matter who would look at them, they could sort of sense something alien about them, about the scenes depicted in these pictures. And the man, Jack said the man was extremely clean, he was a nice person, he was went out of his way to be kind to everyone, and he was a vegetarian. He would not eat meat.
What was the reason for this?
It might have been that the Deros, he probably had seen things that I wouldn't want to discuss. I mean, he probably had seen some pretty horrible things in the caverns. And I doubt very much if he could had a full recall of what happened. But Jack said that he remembers going down into the caverns, being kidnapped and taken into the caverns, and then there was some type of mechanism attached to his head. And Jack said this man still had the scars on his temples where this mechanism Supposedly,
you mean the artist still had the scars.
The artist still had the scars where this mechanism was attached to his temples.
What was the reason for this mechanism to be attached?
Well, the way I see it, John, looking at it from the viewpoint of what we know, I'd say that this mechanism probably made him into a slave or a robot.
Is this what he claims, or he has no knowledge at all?
Well, he believes that is what happened to him.
Did Shaver ever say anything about the possibility of people being made slaves by the
Negroes? Definitely, John, definitely. That was one of his main points. He brought up missing persons, and he claimed that the Dero, for thousands of years, were kidnapping people from the surface and doing it in such a underhanded way that just nobody ever just thought of it. I mean, there's a fantastic amount of persons missing every year, and it's certainly possible to say that they have to be taken somewhere. It's difficult today, with the bureaus we have in the United States here, to just disappear. I mean, we need social security numbers.
Why is it so difficult to disappear?
Well, because identification is more or less required when you apply for a job. If you apply for a defense job in particular, if you apply for a job in a plant which is subsidized by the government...
What would happen if you, Dominic... I don't know what the rules may be, and it just dawned on me now that you've made that statement. What would happen if you left your home in New Jersey and went to another part of this country and assumed another name and you made application for a Social Security card? Would they question you and refuse to give you one? I don't know.
Be honest with you, John. It's so long ago since I applied for my Social Security card.
Well, that's
that
a little different. I mean, because you applied for one many years ago. I mean, let us assume that you go to another part of the country and you take on a new name. You change your name, not legally. In other words, you don't go to court or anything like that. And you change your name to Augie Roberts. Could you walk into a Social Security office and apply for a new card, or would they ask you what happened to your old card?
Well, John, I think that I could. I could. Actually, I agree with you. I think I could.
Get a new card?
I think so.
Now,
absolutely.
If you could get a new Social
absolutely.
Security card, what is the big problem about getting identification?
Well, age would come into be a factor there, John, I think.
What would age have to do with it?
Well, I doubt if anybody would be foolish enough to falsify any papers where they would have to apply to a draft board or where they would have to apply to any job which required some type of civil service exam.
Well, you don't have to take that type of job. In other words, if you're trying to get away from somebody or some situation in the community that you now reside in, and you go to another community in another part of the country. In other words, I'm interested in a statement you made about missing persons. Now, if you go to another part of the country and you get a new draft card, it's quite true you possibly will not get a job with the FBI, but you could get a job working in a restaurant. You could possibly get a job working in a gasoline station as an attendant. And what would be the reason that you need any...
I agree wholeheartedly with that contention, John. I'm not... that isn't the part that interests me. It's not just missing persons. According to what I could discover, the FBI has listed about 120,000 people per year in the United States missing, which is quite a lot of people. And I'm not interested in the majority of missing persons. What I am interested in is the minority groups which disappear without apparent cause or reason. In other words, the fellow whose wife tells him, or tells his wife, he leaves his coat, he leaves everything he practically owns, and runs down to the corner drugstore. Or,
never comes back again.
And just don't come back.
Yeah, this happens. But there's a lot of reasons for these things to happen. Now, certainly, I can't give you the answer, the reason for every person who's ever disappeared, because I don't know the people. But there's a possibility that a man just reaches a point in life that he's going to pack it in. He wants to just divorce himself from all past associations. He doesn't pack a bag. He doesn't take a toothbrush or razor blade. He doesn't even go to the bank and take all the money out. He's got $19.84 in his pocket. And he leaves. Sure, it's a tragic thing. It's a tragic situation for his family. But why wouldn't it be possible to do this? And let me ask you another question. Is it illegal to leave?
Oh,
Providing that you don't take the car that you owe notes on. I think
it is. After all, if the man is married, he can be charged with desertion.
That's right. Let's forget about marriage for a moment. The man is not married. Let's assume that for a moment. Unmarried man who has been working for some company, the XYZ Corporation, possibly as their sales manager. He is not married. His parents passed away a number of years ago, and he's sitting in the local pub, and he figures to himself, why? What is the big struggle for? And he calls the bartender over, and he says, Charlie, what do I owe you? The fellow figures it out. You owe me $3.20. So he throws him four single-dollar bills, leaves him an 80-cent tip, picks up and walks off. Never goes back to his apartment, doesn't pick up the attaché case, doesn't take any of the books or anything. Just disappears.
Well, what we've done, John, now, we got it down to two categories anyway. We got those who have good reason for disappearing, and now we have a percentage of the 120,000 who have no apparently good reason for disappearing, but who disappear on the spur of the moment. And what would you consider the statistical part of that type that you're discussing now?
You mean they just walk off?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I can give you an answer to that question any more than you can give me an answer and tell me what percentage you think of the people that have been grabbed.
Well, I don't...
Kidnapped or what have you by the zeros.
I don't particularly think anything in particular on that particular point. But what I do say is that the possibility exists. And the fact is, 120,000 people is a lot of people.
Suppose, Tom, say out of 120,000 people, at least maybe 5 or 10 or maybe even a little more.
Well, remember, Augie, we're only talking of one country now. This concerns the whole earth. It's not only one country.
Well, suppose they were picked up by the police for some reason or other, a minor infraction, say, or they did something quite bad and their fingerprints were checked. Wouldn't that bring out their original name even if they changed
it? Oh, that happens every day, Augie. I mean, that happens every day.
No, why would a fingerprint that? My fingerprints are not registered any place, to my knowledge.
Well, mine are, I know, from the Army Service and Civil Defense.
That's right. But no, those records are not kept.
The records?
The FBI keeps the Army records?
I know if I do anything wrong,
so.
That my fingerprints are checked.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
Well, what I was getting at there is that there are countries in the world who don't keep as close a check on missing persons as the United States. They haven't got the law enforcement agencies we have here. And take in India, for instance. There could be thousands upon thousands of people missing in India, and very few people would know about it because of the area, the lack of policed citizenry working to stop or alleviate the condition of people just disappearing. In India, you have people who are actually die of starvation while they're on their feet, practically. And actually, I doubt if statistics are kept to any great accuracy in India. So we'll take just India alone, a country like India.
So why go to India all of a sudden? We're missing 120,000 people, Dominic. I don't know why we should pick on India. We got 120,000 people that are missing, and you have implied that there's a possibility that maybe there's a percentage, maybe only 10 people out of 120,000 people that are kidnapped by the D-Rose.
Well, we'd have to sort of break it down into categories, and then we have to figure from a viewpoint of percentage.
How can you break anything down into categories when you know nothing about it?
I think that by going to a missing persons bureau or speaking to a missing persons expert,
mm-hmm.
we can get a statistical average of why people disappear. And by breaking down the known average, we could arrive and deduce those that, according to the probability ratio, would not disappear by any normal explanation.
Dom, do most people disappear in remote areas of the United States?
Well, I would put it this way, Augie. I don't
disappear
know.
Disappear to or disappear from, do you mean?
Disappear
Augie?
From, say, a special area.
Small
communities or people walking in the country somewhere.
I would say this,
alone?
That a person living in a small community, if he disappears, it would be more noticeable. But it would also be less known to those who live in larger communities.
Well, don't the Darrows usually operate in the remote parts of the country?
Well, no. Strangely enough, that isn't so. In fact, according to Shaver, many of the larger cities in the United States have a surface Darrow population.
Well, is it possible to disappear right in your own room, Dom?
Well, there's another fantastic claim by Richard S. Shaver, and he claims that the Darrows have in their possession mechanisms which can, by scientific knowledge or means, by utilizing certain rays, create what we may term a state of teleport in the human body. In other words, people could disappear from a closed and locked room.
Are you familiar with the story? I'm sure you are, Don, with the tape I have of this fellow who sent it to us. And he made the claim that while he was laying in bed one night, he remembered the story we told, or was told, a number of months ago with Hall and Ellison. If he was to make a large noise and start yelling, "I want to see a Darrow," that the Darrows would come to him? This point I want to bring out.
Well, Augie, strangely enough, I'm going to have to disagree with that. I don't think that any particular fit, like it was claimed there that you had a more or less perform, would bring a Darrow to teleport you to the caverns.
Well, no, this fellow made the claim that...
I think Palmer made that claim, actually. Well, I think Palmer made that claim in a letter that he wrote to John.
Well, where the fellow...
You're talking about the letter he wrote to me?
In reference to Holland Ellison, in which he said that if Ellison would take his shoes off and throw him on the floor, yell at the top of his voice. Well, personally, I think if Ellison did something like that, I think the Darrows wouldn't take him away. I think it would be the men in the white coats.
Well, what I wanted to say, Don, was that this fella here made a loud noise, and he wanted to see a Darrow, and he was lying down in bed. Maybe he went to sleep, I don't know, but he said he felt something grab his leg and start jerking him off the bed there. You know?
Well,
he almost fell on the floor.
You made a statement there, Augie, that I don't particularly buy. I don't think... I've never actually seen a Darrow, which I could prove was a Darrow. I've seen people who could fit the description probably both physiologically and mentally both.
Mm-hmm.
But I've certainly never seen anyone I could prove was a Darrow. I don't know. I can't say that a Darrow would not come to your room were you to perform that strange series of antics.
Fellas, if I may interrupt, no, I think actually that Ray Palmer was trying to be facetious, and at the same time, he was trying to make a point. In other words, actually, according to that letter, and I haven't got it, I have it someplace in my files out in Parsippany, New Jersey, my home, but I know that he was pretty peeved at Harlan Ellison, because Harlan had made a couple of statements ridiculing Ray on the program. He ridiculed Ray Palmer. And I think this is the reason that Ray wrote that letter. There was some discussion on the program. Harlan made a statement that he met Ray Palmer in an elevator cab. They were going up or coming down from one of the floors in the hotel at a science fiction convention. And the two of them were in the elevator alone, plus naturally the operator. And Harlan made the statement that Ray Palmer said that the whole thing was a farce, that he had written it to increase the circulation of amazing stories. Well, of course, this is fine. This is something that he should do. He should try to increase the circulation of any publication that he may be the editor of. But to do it in that way would be wrong. Now, whether Ray ever said this or not, I will never be in a position to say. But Ray Palmer has denied it emphatically. He claims that he never spoke to Harlan Ellison. I shouldn't say that he never spoke to Harlan Ellison, but he never discussed the Shaver mysteries. Do you know a funny thing, Dominic? You told me that the correct pronunciation is D-Rose, and I've noticed the last 20 minutes you've been saying Darrow's. What is it?
Oh, I guess it's force of habit, John.
A lot of people say Darrow's, don't they?
Darrow, more
no,
or less.
That's what I thought.
It's a lazy way of doing it, actually.
A lazy way of doing it. All right. I think we, at the time that I interrupted to take care of a little business, Dominic, I think that... I'm sorry, don't you know...
I've heard Ben many a time over the year, John.
Augie Roberts and Dominic Lucchesi.
Hi.
You were into a discussion. You were talking about the possibility of a small percentage. In fact, you didn't even say small percentage. I'm assuming that this is what you think anyway. That a percentage of the 120,000 missing people that statistics tell us are missing every year, some small percentage may have been kidnapped by the D-Rose. That a percentage of the 120,000 missing people that statistics tell us are missing every year, some small percentage may have been kidnapped by the D-Rose.
Yes, John, we were into that in
the I like the way you start. Yes, John. In other words, you really believe this?
Believe that a certain percentage of missing persons cannot be accounted for by normal explanation.
Oh, now please. I agree with you that they cannot be accounted for. Any person who is missing and they've never been able to trace him, then they cannot account for them.
No, well, my contention is, John, that certain ones, certain of these missing people, cannot be accounted for by any normal explanation. What I meant by that is by any known cause.
Well, if I leave my home and they never find a body, they never get a letter from me, they know nothing about me, they never hear of me, would you call that by normal means?
You would become a statistic, Jeremy.
That's right. So you, Dominic Lucchesi, may take this statistic and say the D-Rose kidnapped.
Well, there's a possibility, John. I don't know. They might kidnap you, or I can't say they won't.
That isn't the thing. You honestly believe this, though?
Do I honestly believe that the D-Rose particularly kidnap anyone?
Like Judge Crater, for instance.
I don't know, Ben, actually. And we were awaiting your getting here in order for you to try and clarify this one particular point. 120,000 people disappear, and we were discussing the fact that many of these people disappear for good reason. Then there's others who do not appear to disappear for any good reason. In other words, they just go down to the corner store for a pack of cigarettes and never come back. And John had arrived at that one particular point there where he said there is also a possibility that these people decide on the spur of the moment to disappear at that particular time for no reason. Now, we granted that we have two types of people that disappear now. We have the people that disappear for good cause, whether they're evading the law or whether they just want to give it all up and just disappear. And we have the people who disappear who have no apparent foreknowledge of this disappearance. In other words, they don't think about it. It's not predetermined. They just happen to do it on the spur of the moment.
Well, in order for a disappearance to be successful, it would have to appear that way, wouldn't it? I mean, the very fact that someone is missing and cannot be traced seems to me to be abnormal. And the very fact that someone wants not to be traced means that he would plan it as if it were the most casual thing, as if he were swallowed up.
Not necessarily, because actually I think I myself, if I was going to disappear, I would make sure that I would have certain things with me. I certainly wouldn't disappear in my shirt sleeves, or disappear in my undershirt in the summertime, or disappear in my slippers, so to speak.
Yeah, but if I wanted a successful disappearance, I mean, I don't know how... I know the most famous case is Judge Crater, who I know a little bit about because I knew some of the people of the Bar Association.
You mean we're
going to have an expose of the Judge Crater case this morning?
No, but I know what led up to it. I mean, and the rest of it, he just walked out of the Bar Association one night. He was going to meet his wife for dinner. He said goodnight to the elevator operator. He got into a cab, and he was never seen of again. Now, I think this... I don't know why or how Judge Crater disappeared. Well, I assure you that if I wanted to make a successful disappearance, I wouldn't go to the bank and draw out a lot of money, and I wouldn't suddenly order new luggage, and I wouldn't have my... deposits transferred to other banks and all that. I found that I have a tremendous bank account.
I would walk out if it was a...
I'd walk out with a T-shirt on
and the old slats and just disappear.
John,
because this is the... Because everybody's saying, what could have happened to him? He didn't take any money.
He didn't steal any money.
He didn't leave the bank, you know what I mean, and steal the till. He didn't take any luggage. He didn't even take his favorite electric razor or his favorite pipe that he smokes.
Yeah, and this all leads up to the fact that the most important point about making a successful disappearance is to make it look like it isn't a disappearance.
I was wondering, John, whether Judge Crater ever got out of that elevator.
That I don't know.
Maybe he pushed
it. He got into a taxi cab and disappeared.
Oh, are they certain of that? I mean,
there are rumors that he still haunts the stacks at the Bar Association Library. But I mean, the last I heard, he's never been found.
Well, I don't know, Ben. I'm not an expert on disappearances. Actually, what I am doing here is we were describing this mystery which was started by Richard S. Shaver in Amazing Stories. That was back in 1945.
Yeah, I know about that.
One of Shaver's more or less contentions was that many of the people who disappear, and he didn't give any particular percentage, he said many of the people who disappear are kidnapped by these Vero who reside in the caverns beneath the earth.
What are the Vero's wallet?
According to Shaver, they used them as slaves and for their own nefarious purposes. The Deros are supposedly a degenerate race of beings, very cruel, very evil, very negative. And it was Shaver's contention that they did not stop or would not stop at kidnapping a surface being and taking him to the caverns for experimental purposes, for purposes of utilizing them for work, and for various other purposes, which I would not care to mention.
Well, all the percentage, say 160,000 successful disappearances that no one knows anything about, and say roughly, say a few percent of these were caused by Deros, it's very probable that a small percentage, say two or three or five people, would have escaped from the Deros and would have come back and told us.
Well, we have definite... we have stories about people who have escaped from the Deros.
Yeah, we always have stories.
In fact, Gray Barker visited a woman in Pennsylvania, I believe it was.
I think we should tell our listeners who Gray Barker is. There's a possibility that somebody may be listening and didn't hear him on that particular night.
Oh, I see. Gray Barker is a researcher. He is a successful businessman who went into saucer research. He got extremely interested due to a case of the West Virginia Monster, where these people in Virginia sighted some form of thing. And later on, Gray became associated with Mr. Roberts and myself through the International Flying Saucer Bureau, which was run by a person by the name of Albert K. Bender. And... one evening, three men came to Bender's house wearing dark suits and Homburg hats, and Mr. Bender was no longer talking. Now, strangely enough, there are parts of the Shaver mystery which seem to parallel the Bender mystery. But getting back to Mr. Barker visited this woman in Pennsylvania. I can't recall the woman's name. It is on record. I have it, Gray has it, and Augie probably has it somewhere at home. And this woman claimed that she had actually lived in the caverns for many years. And her story, more or less, and though she didn't have any amazing stories in her house at the time, or she didn't read science fiction, she happened to be a very old woman at the time when Gray visited her, she did claim that she had lived in the caverns, and her story paralleled what Shaver claimed to be fact. Now, I happened to start something there which was interesting, and I'd like to bring it up at this time. When I said that this Bender incident, the Bridgeport incident, that is, of Bender being hushed up by three men, strangely enough, Ray Palmer informed a number of people that the FBI investigated Shaver. And in Palmer's own words, what they told him was one fact, that's quoting from Palmer, was one fact which made it difficult to drop the mystery. In other words, what these FBI men told Richard S. Shaver made it difficult for Shaver to drop the mystery. Not that he would have anyway, I doubt that, but...
What was this thing?
What they told him, I have never been able to find out, and it's just as much a mystery as what the three men who visited Mr. Albert K. Bender told him, which frightened him so badly that he didn't eat nor sleep for 2 days, was it, or?
3 days.
3 days? For 3 days, and prior to that, both Augie and myself had known Mr. Bender very intimately. We were very good friends of Bender's. We were helping him put out this magazine that he used to publish. He had a worldwide organization. 3 days before the event occurred, he had received an article from me which dealt with some form of interplanetary power, if I recall correctly. It was for a new column which was to go into his little publication, which was called Space Review. And 3 days prior to Bender's visit, Bender had accepted this article and told me that Space Review would be published, as usual, and that there would be some startling things contained therein. Unfortunately, that particular issue of Space Review, which Bender referred to, never was published. It just never got to the printer, I don't think, Augie, did it?
Which one was that, Don? The last one?
Final issue before Bender had to revise it at the request of the three men.
There are lots of saucer publications, lots of people interested in saucer research. For instance, Jim Moseley.
Who's a very fine researcher.
Which is a very fine saucer man, who's never been silenced. There's Van Tassel, Andamsky.
Well, you have to remember one thing
who
about...
claim all sorts of contacts. There's Howard Menager, who's never been visited by three men in black dogs.
There is one thing, though, Ben. Around that time, it was the beginning of the saucer groups, and they silenced the top group at that time. And as...
why wouldn't they continue this policy of
silence?
Because
they found out they made an error.
Isn't it Gray Barker's contention that he's not the only one who's been silenced?
Well,
these three men have visited?
There was Gerald of the Australian Flying Saucer Bureau. There was a fellow up in New Zealand. A fellow up in Canada. All of these have been silenced and frightened.
Yeah, well, this point about... let me get this straight. Ray Palmer said that there was one point that the FBI men mentioned to him...
Not to Palmer, to Shaver.
To Shaver.
Right.
That would not permit Shaver to drop it. Because it was so startling.
Well, here is Palmer's...
And then never went on to say what this statement was. Now, I mean, forgive me for sounding a little harsh, but this sounds like a typical Palmer action. I mean, I recall a certain piece of metal that was lost somewhere outside Seattle that was supposed to be definite proof of a saucer landing.
That was the Maury Island incident.
Would you please tell me what
I
you consider
think that
as
was
a typical Palmer action?
Just what I mentioned.
What is one particular incident that you mentioned? Is that a typical Palmer action? In other words, Palmer claims in some book to have lost a piece of metal. Is that a typical...
No, Palmer claims to have a piece of metal.
Well, is that a typical...
And then claims the FBI took it away from him, and then it was lost in an airplane crash outside of Seattle.
Airplane crash is on record. Two men lost their lives in the crash. I don't think Palmer would more or less... how would you say it? Express lightly anything such as a crash where two men lost their lives. Augie Roberts is one of the few people I know who actually went to Maury Island and investigated the scene of this incident. And I think that you did find that certain points in the story did check as far as you were able to ascertain. Isn't
that correct? One good point that I would like to know and would like to get the answers of, and that is the fact that why did the Coast Guardmen, there are three sets of Coast Guardmen there, and they operate this lighthouse. Actually, Maury Island is a lighthouse station. Why 3 days later they were taken off this lighthouse and sent to another part of the country and three new groups were sent in?
Don't they regularly rotate these attendants at lighthouses?
Right after this incident?
Well, what that means is that the incident could have happened.
The incident could have happened on such and such a day, and the next day was the regular day for these men to be relieved.
We have to allow that possibility.
That is true.
And in other words, Ben, what you're trying to say is that you do not believe in the silence group. Is that correct?
No. What I'm trying to say is that I don't like anybody coming out and saying that, I don't like anyone coming out and saying something that there was one fact revealed which made it impossible to drop this mystery. Unfortunately, I either don't know or cannot reveal this fact. This, to me, is a journalistic stunt.
Well, Ben, actually, let's put it this way.
In other words, there is something called X, which if you knew about, would shake you to the very roots, but unfortunately, I can't tell you about it.
Doesn't that possibility exist? I think there are many men in this world right at this very moment in a position where they know things that would be earth-shaking in context, and they cannot tell due to security reasons.
Yeah.
So I don't see where your point holds so much...
Well, this strikingly parallels this incident, the Maury Island incident, where there was a piece of metal that was supposed to be definitive proof about the interplanetary origin of flying saucers, because... First of all, the metal defied chemical analysis or something else, and this thing was being rushed, and all of a sudden it disappeared. Now, this again is the fact that isn't there. I mean, this is a thing that happens. It's happened twice so far with Palmer's connection with sources. I'm just pointing out that this is a method which I am very suspicious of. As far as I don't like it, it's sort of untidy as far as I'm concerned, referring to the fact that unfortunately cannot be exhibited. This is like taking a secret file into a courtroom and pointing to it and saying, within this secret file there are documents that prove that this man is the worst kind of monster. Unfortunately, we cannot open the file, but you should convict this man. I mean, It is a low trick, actually.
Well, tell me, Ben, let's assume the hypothesis that you and I were investigating a certain phenomena in reference to flying saucers, and you happen to obtain a metallic object or a space clock or a space instrument of some type that would definitely establish the fact that this particular vehicle is... manufactured by a superior technology far beyond our own. And the FBI came to your house, and they said to you, Ben, we don't want you to divulge the information about this particular clock. In other words, we don't care. Go out and say anything else you want, but don't mention this space clock or this space speed instrument. Don't mention it. You have, as a good citizen, we're putting you on your honor not to state this one particular fact of the incident. State anything else you want. Say you saw a saucer. Say you were in it. But don't state this particular fact. And then you, as my co-worker in attempting to arrive at a solution to this problem...
You ask me what I would
do. You would not say to me, Dom, you're wasting your time. You might as well stop right now. I happen to know what the answer is, but I can't tell you. Stop wasting your money. Don't take any more photographs. And it's useless because I know. You mean to tell me you wouldn't tell me anything at all, in other words?
I'll tell you exactly what I would do. Unfortunately, it's a hypothetical case, so it can never be proven, and it may sound a little bit of a sham. But I, for one, am certain the FBI would never approach me in that respect. And if they did, I would tell them to go jump in the lake.
Well, I don't think that you'd get away with it, then.
I don't think you would.
Then I tell them to declare this object national security material and to classify it and take it away.
They probably would immediately, right in the box.
But they didn't take this away from Ray Palmer. They made him promise. Now, this does not sound like... I'm not familiar with FBI technique, but this does not sound like FBI technique. You don't get promises from people. If something is important to the national security, it is not in your possession anymore. It is classified, taken away.
In other words, what you're saying is that a man, Palmer must be about 42 years old, I believe. Is that right, Arthur?
I believe so, Don.
All right, a man that's lived 42 years is not entitled to two particular incidents in his life which don't make sense to Ben Iskowitz.
As far as flying saucers are concerned?
Ben, I feel this way.
I mean, that don't seem to ring true to me, Ben. I don't think you actually mean what you said.
Ben, I feel this way, that if you didn't adhere to the FBI ruling, we would miss you around here.
Fine. Then they'd have to come into a court and they'd have to say...
I don't think we would get that far to a court. We would just miss you, like you people would be missing like today.
Missing you? Are you suggesting the FBI would incarcerate me?
Yeah. They don't agree with Ben Iskowitz. They just take him and without a warrant for his arrest or a search warrant for his home or anything like that, they just pick him up?
There's a possibility.
I hope all good FBI men are sound asleep tonight.
Please, Augie, I'm absolutely surprised.
But that is an incredible statement, Augie.
Well, I certainly hope they would, John. Actually, because if you're endangering the national security, I think any method would be appropriate at that particular moment.
I'd rather go by the laws on the books. That's the way I want.
Yeah, very fortunately, there's still something in this country called due process, and the FBI could not lock me up without. I assure you that I don't know very much about the law, but I assure you I'd have a habeas corpus action served in 24 hours, and they'd have to bring me to trial, and they'd have to tell me why I am being brought to trial, and if I go to prison, why I am going to prison. And then if I'm stealing the classified security material or something like that, then it would come out. I think this is a much better way.
Well, Ben, you think that you should have the right to tell them, right?
Yes, I think if something definitely proves interplanetary origin of sources, people should be told.
Augie Roberts, Dominic Lucchesi, and Ben Iskowitz. Ben?
Yeah, we were talking about the fact about... what direct proof of the interplanetary origin of sources would mean. Now, the reason I'm pretty sure I would behave this way, and the reason why I think this is a very important point is essentially this, is that I think that if it is true that the sources are of interplanetary origin, this is the greatest news fact in the last 2,000 years, practically. The fact that there is another civilization existing on another planet somewhere that is capable of such a technology, by some way made some sort of discovery of our world. It's very important from a number of things. I remember one night after the show having coffee with Charlie Leadham and talking about it. And more or less we came to the idea that if this civilization had advanced to a technology which could send sources to our world, they're far ahead of us in many respects. And history teaches the one sad fact that every time one culture that is technologically superior to another comes in contact with an inferior culture, that inferior culture soon vanishes. Now, if only for this reason, it's very important about the truth or the falseness of sources' stories and sources' reports. For this reason, I'm very interested in it, and for a lot of reasons, I don't like a lot of the wildness and a lot of the lunatic fringe that go on about sources. Now, there is one concrete fact that I keep on going over, which I will put forth as what I consider to be a fact. The one most significant thing in sources, the one that made me change my mind, the one that made me think there is something flying around up there, which is as far as I'll go, was the second Washington sightings. Now this,
the District of Columbia?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is something that was concrete, was seen by several people, was radar contact and visual contact at the same time, contact by pursuit planes, interceptor ships sent up by the Air Force. This, to me, is a concrete fact, not the piece of metal that disappears and not the information told to somebody, which I can't reveal to you, unfortunately, but would stun you if I told you. Now, this is why I perhaps am a little pedantic on this point.
You don't believe
that? Well, what I'd like to get at is one point there, and I'd like to know how we got on flying saucers.
We were talking about it when I came in.
We were talking about flying saucers.
No, it was just mentioned at one time, but actually we haven't been discussing it.
Especially from outer space.
I don't believe in outer space.
I'm not talking about saucers from outer space. I'm talking about beings who reside in the caverns beneath the Earth.
You think these three men in dark suits were not FBI agents? They were Deros?
I don't know, Ben. I think, personally, as my own personal opinion, that they were definitely from some agency of the government.
Our government.
Our government.
Yes.
And I'd go so far as to say that I think that there are agencies in our government which are far more secret and far more powerful than the FBI. That's only an opinion on my part, of course. And actually what we were getting at was the point and where I was just explaining what Shaver told Palmer and which Palmer related as having been told him by Shaver. I certainly did give no definite opinion on what I thought in particular about anything that Shaver had said to Palmer being true or about Palmer saying anything true to Shaver or to anyone else. All I am doing is recounting the Shaver mystery, which I found extremely interesting. I did not say anything about truth. I did not say anything about fact or fiction. That is what I am trying to find out. I said there are many interesting facets of this particular mystery which are intriguing by their very nature and which lead one into certain fields of research which in themselves are extremely interesting. Now, what I would like to do is sort of give a resume to bring you up to date, Ben, on the whole mystery, which I haven't done all evening, actually, from the very beginning. I won't go into the actual publication of it. I've related that before. What I would like to do is give you Shaver's version of history on Earth, a history which started, according to Shaver, 20,000 years ago. Shaver claimed that 20,000 years ago, there was a race of beings who lived on the Earth, and they called themselves Titans and Atlans, which is sort of parallel with Atlantis. Now, actually, strangely enough, now, one of the first things I did when I began to read Shaver, I don't believe what I read, contrary to what you may think. There was a book written many years ago. I've never had the opportunity of seeing the book. I have only seen it in bibliographies. I've seen it referred to. And that was, I believe, and correct me if you know anything about this author, a fellow by the name of, I think it was pronounced Bulwer Lytton. Did you ever hear of anybody, an author by that name? Bulwer Lytton.
L-Y-T-T-O-N?
B-Y-L-W-A-R, something like that.
How's he spell his last name?
L-Y-T-O-N-A, something like that. Now, this is something that I saw referred to, and he wrote a book called The Coming Race, which did refer to an underground race of beings. And he certainly referred to it long before Shaver ever considered receiving voices from a welding machine. Now, Shaver claims that these thought records, which he received through this welding machine, consisted of a history of this planet, planet Earth. It is Shaver's claim that these beings actually colonized the Earth ages ago, way back in the past. And when we get to the 20,000-year period of the present, I mean, it's strange to call 20,000 years the present, but according to Shaver, 20,000 years ago, these people, they had a superior science. They had vehicles which were similar in design to what we term today flying saucers. And remember, Shaver was speaking of sorcerers many, well, not many years, but previous to Kenneth Arnold's original sighting. He claimed these Titans and Atlans found out that a sun, a star such as ours, as it ages, it throws out detrimental rays of energy which cause age. According to Shaver, these beings, these Titans and Atlans, used to live to be 1,000 years old. And they found that as the sun aged and the reactions changed, the sun began throwing out these detrimental rays of energy which caused age. Therefore, they constructed these vast network of caverns beneath the earth in order to escape the direct rays of the sun and put enough earth between them as sort of an insulation against this detrimental energy which was radiating from the sun. Now, when they went down into the caverns, they brought with them a vast array of scientific mechanisms consisting of fantastic machines which could teleport objects, which could move things at a distance, which could melt earth and any known element. Actually, they may have had the power of the element, which Blavatsky refers to in her book, and she called it Vril, V-R-I-L. This Vril was supposed to be some type of sidereal force, which would mean some type of cosmic energy, which they had harnessed and utilized for their own purposes. Shaver also claimed that these Titans were very large in size. I wouldn't say, when he called them giants, I wouldn't say that he meant 100 foot tall, but he claimed these people to be about 15, 20 feet tall. Now, they went into the caverns, and then they brought these mechanisms with them to supplement the rays of the sun, which they were no longer exposed to. Now, as these mechanisms in some way drew their energy from the surface, these mechanisms actually, instead of throwing out the beneficial rays they were designed for, after a period of time, these mechanisms became contaminated by a detrimental source of energy. In other words, they became contaminated and began to throw out a detrimental energy which degenerated the race which was living in the caverns. And according to Shaver, the Titans and the Atlans escaped the Earth and went to another planet in these spaceships, which were similar, as I said before, to the sources of today. And his claim is that Atlantis, or Atlan, or Lemuria, or Mu, did not sink beneath the ocean. In other words, throughout the ages, the legend has become misconstrued. That, and actually, what it was referring to was that the people went beneath the earth, the people of this particular continent. The engineer just brought in this...
Go ahead.
This note, and it refers to the book that I was trying to tell you about before, Ben. And the name of the book is The Coming Race by Lord Lytton, I believe, published in London in 1891 by George Rutledge and Son. And that was the book. I didn't know quite that much information about it. I had recalled seeing it referred to in various publications. So there it is. That's about it. Capitulation of it. These Daros, being degenerate beings, not all, of course, because according to Shaver, there are Tiros who have managed to escape the harmful rays of these mechs, as he calls them. And strangely enough, the word in phonetic tongue, in other words, the tongue that Shaver claims to have received as being the basic tongue of man, due to its phonetic character, lends itself to a wide, admittedly wide interpretation. And it seems that Mech seems to work out just right in this phonetic spelling, that is M-E-K. But these Ray Mechs, as Shaver calls them, that these people supposedly have control of, they utilize for fiendish and diabolical purposes. In other words, they harass surface beings with these rays, just as a child would sort of tantalize an ant. And they create what the psychic, what we call psychic phenomena. They do this purely as a fiendish diversion, more or less. And they do create accidents, air accidents. They create all types of strange disappearances and disturbances on the surface. And Shaver included this, the ignition of people who are sitting in their living room, and they're the only things in the whole room that are destroyed or consumed. You're familiar with that? That's about it, Ben. Did I leave anything out that you would be curious about or anything you would like to know?
No, you brought up the point that I remember reading the last thing Shaver wrote in a magazine that Ray Palmer published. It was a saucer issue of amazing stories, and Ray Palmer edited that one issue again, or it was amazing saucer stories or something, and Shaver had an article in which he claimed, which he made the claim, obviously again, that the saucers are actually the Deros riding around in the ships filled with their superior technology. There's one thing I'd like to know, is that why do they just bother harassing us? Why don't they just, I mean, since they're so superior and fiendish and diabolical, why don't they just take back the surface of the planet again?
Well, probably their conditioning, their environment, they are accustomed to it. Actually, their cavern world would be to them what our world is to us. Strangely enough, one point I did forget there, Ben, that Shaver claims that the sorcerers that we see today are not here for the betterment of humanity. They are not here to help anyone. They are from other planets plundering the mechanisms, these wonderful mechanisms which are in the caves. In other words, they are here to take these mechanisms back to their own planet. They are plundering the caves. And that's what Shaver claimed.
Now, I think what we should do at this time, Dominic, is explain to our listeners the details of this test that you intend to conduct.
Well, John, before I go into the actual details, I would like to relate a little test Augie and myself conducted a few years back, and it was in reference to Adamski's book. Now, in Adamski's book, there was a plate, photographic plate, which supposedly was thrown out of the saucer, and which Adamski picked up, and he claimed that this plate, when it was developed, had an odd diagram of a disc on it, and it had this strange writing. Now, we happen to find that this writing was similar to Urdu, which is a Hindu form of writing. So, Augie and I sat down, and we deciphered the Hindu into phonetic terms. And then we took the Hindu and we put it into the Shaver alphabet, man tongue, as Shaver called it. And we derived from this translation a strange message, which I think Augie has more or less memorized since then. Do you recall the message, Augie?
Well, the message was, Dom, will you and all men stay away, disintegrating powers whose source is sun's energy will destroy life.
Oh, another way, more or less, keep away from atomic power is what it
said.
That's about it properly.
That's about the way I...
Now, you recall at the time that it took us about
8 hours.
8 hours to do the job, and that was to double-check ourselves, actually. Now, what I would like to do, if the listeners have their pencil and papers ready, I would like to give them the phonetic version of man tongue, which was supposedly the alphabet used by the Titans and Atlans who occupied this planet prior to 20,000 years ago. Now, if everyone is ready, we're going to give the first letter, which is A. Our A stands for animal. Can be used as AN for short. In other words, M. That's the letter A. Now, the next letter is B, which meant, in this ancient tongue, according to Shaver, of course, to exist, to be. To exist, the letter B. Now, C, pronounced in phonetic alphabet, con, C-O-N. It means to see,
to comprehend and to understand. The next letter is D, D-E, which is detrimental. D-I-S, this, for short. Detrimental energy concept in that letter D, actually used as D-E. Then we have E, which means energy and motion. F, which means fecund. F-E-C-U-N-D. Used F-E. F-E. G is a concept of generation, to generate. H has a metaphysical connotation. Even Shaver himself admitted that he couldn't quite understand the ancient concept behind the letter H. He knew it had something to do with H-man, or human, etc., etc. I, the letter I, stands for ego, or self. Now, J stands, strangely enough, for generation, but a different form of generation. It would be what was known to the Atlans as animal generation. And it is associated, or likened, to the letter G, only with the difference of being an animal association to generation. K stands for kinetics, or the power of motion, etc. L is for life. A good word example, actually, to use in this part of the alphabet would be the word, in our language, vital. Vital, which we will use later and we will derive the meaning from. N is for man. N is for seed or spore, sort of a source concept. O stands for orifice. P stood for power. Q stood for quest. R is a horror symbol, danger, used as AR, which in the ancient tongue supposedly meant a dangerous quantity of disintegrant force. S stands for sun, used S-I-S, sis, S-I-S. T is the most important symbol. It stands for the force of growth. According to Shaver, the actual T concept was the cause for the intake of gravity, which is a little difficult to comprehend, actually. T-I-C, which is still working from the letter T, is the science of growth and integration. U stands for you, as an individual, you. V stands for vital. Can also be used as VI. Also, there's an animal magnetism concept attached to the letter V. W stands for will, the power of will. X is a conflict, and according to Shaver, was created to depict force lines crossing. Y stands for the word, W-H-Y, which is sort of a question or reason. Z stands for zero, and according to Shaver, meant a quantity of T, which is integrative energy, neutralized by an equal quantity of D, which is more or less disintegrant energy, also stands for futility. Now, I can't recall, were there any other letters there, Augie, that I miss any?
You miss X and you miss T.
Well, X I stand.
You mentioned for. That.
Conflict?
Yeah, now, and Z, actually, is a zero quantity. According to Shaver, that was the Z as a quantity of T neutralized by an equal quantity of D. The D also could mean futility of some type, according to Shaver. Now, basically, this alphabet will work out in different languages, supposedly, and according to Shaver, it will not work, or it does not work to a large degree in the Romance languages. such as Italian and French. I've tried it myself in these languages, and I find that it's extremely difficult to derive any meaning from the word, whatever word we try to decipher. Now, I want to go back to the word vital just to give an idea of just how this alphabet would work. Now, vital is a vital force, an animal magnetism, V-I. T is integration. A is animal, and L is life, which would give a sort of a concept of power, of vital force. Actually, the word vital and the V-I, which Shaver claims practically meant vital, would stand for itself, more or less. So, therefore, it's an easy word to work with. Now, Ben, have you got any ideas on this alphabet?
Yeah, this sounds exactly like the Kabbalah to me, with certain letters sounding like... I'm intrigued by these things. The letter Y means the word Y, and that the letter I means ego, or essentially I. And this is something that's sort of very interesting to me. It's sort of the identification you make between the sound of a letter and a word, which happens in a phonetic alphabet.
It's more than
phonetic when you identify the letter Y with the word Y.
See, Shaver admits that this is not complete, but he does claim that this will work out in certain words. Now, I have found through use of it that it does work out. Now, whether Shaver here created what we may term a generalized alphabet, which to me seems a little difficult for one of Shaver's standing, actually.
Well, what was his standing?
Well, I mean, he must have got the idea from somewhere. Now, I don't say that he necessarily got it from the caves, or that it was the original alphabet used by the people of Earth, in other words, the mother tongue of the planet. I do say that it is interesting. And I think that if the listeners would use a few words and work this out, and write to Long John in care of this station, I think that they could... We could actually have something to work with. In other words, we could have a quantity of derivations which should be interesting. Don't you think so, Ben?
The point that intrigues me is that if this is the alphabet of a language that is prior to all known languages, and which is, as you point out, doesn't even fit in with Romance languages, why in the world do they have the 26 letters of the 26 Arabic letters? I mean, I couldn't understand why. Why wouldn't they, for instance, have? Why wouldn't they have, say, 56 letters in their alphabet? And why shouldn't the first letter be Og and the second letter Zepic or something like that?
Well, according to Shaver, he claims that gradually, through certain subtle forces which react on humanity or surface beings, that the original language of the Titans is again being revived. In other words, our English language is one of the closest languages to the original mother tongue of the planet Earth.
Well, that would mean that the language of the ancient Phoenicians was almost identical with the Pharaohs, because the alphabet comes from the Phoenicians, mostly.
Well, the Phoenicians actually were after the cataclysm. Now, remember, all this Shaver mystery depends on the fact of a race of beings which inhabited the Earth in pre-cataclysmic times.
May I interrupt a moment, gentlemen? I had to step out of the studio so that I could go to the newsroom, and I was just wondering, have you definitely set up the
test? Yes, we've set up the alphabet, John. I believe the listeners who are interested have copied it down.
Okay.
And I'm quite sure that if they derive anything, whether it's negative or positive on this, I think that...
What do you think should analyze? Is there something to be analyzed here?
No, more or less, John. It's just a matter of interpretation.
I see. Well, and what did you suggest for them to do? To send it in to me?
That's right, John.
I think we should put something on there, because I don't want to open up all these letters. I'd rather turn them over to you or to Ben. Ben, do you think that as a cybernetician, this doesn't count, huh? This is not a branch of cybernetics.
I'd be happy to figure them out.
All right, I'll tell you what.
I'm trying to figure out the word cybernetics in this alphabet right now.
If you'll send your answer to Ben Isquith, I-S-Q-U-I-T-H. Ben Isquith, I-S-Q-U-I-T-H. Care of Long John, Station WOI, New York 18. Now, don't include it in a letter that you may send to me, because I will not have the opportunity of reading these. We'll give them to Ben. Ben, in turn, will contact Mr. Lucchesi and Mr. Roberts, and maybe in another 3-4 weeks from now, we'll take a few minutes to talk about it and find out what happened. You agree, Ben?
Very fine. I'd be very interested.
I think it would be very interesting, John, to see what happens. And actually, the word cybernetics works out very well using the Shaver alphabet.
Would you tell us more about that, please?
Well, cybernetics, again, we have concept in the alphabet, and that's the difficult part. It's a mental concept that this is supposed to convey when a word is broken down.
Pardon me a moment if I'm interrupting. As you realize, I had to step out of the studio for a couple of minutes. When you say concept, is this in relationship to concept therapy? Is there any connection?
No, John, no connection whatsoever that I know.
Very interesting subject.
But cybernetics works out would be something like the C in cybernetics. Now, actually, the C in cybernetics would mean to comprehend. C-O-N, comprehend.
Why wouldn't
the
it be
C.
concept, too? Why wouldn't it be confidence? Comprehend?
No.
No?
It's a mental concept. It's a source concept, John. And the C would mean to comprehend or to understand. The Y is used as a question mark. Is why? Why do we have to understand? The B is we have to understand to exist. B stands for to exist. E, I hope I have the word spelled right, by the way. C-Y-B-E-R-N-E-I-C. Where was I, Ben?
You're just getting to exist.
Yeah, in other words, why do we have, what do we have to see to exist, more or less? E is energy. And R, naturally, is the horror concept. Because behind all energy, what they mean by that is in energy, there is danger. And that is the way, more or less, Shaver himself interpreted the alphabet. In energy, there is danger. In other words, why do we have to comprehend? In energy, there is danger. The source of this energy is basically integrative, indicated by the T. And then it finishes the word off with I see. I see, and then the S, see? In other words, I see, and then we have the S concept. Now, just what is S? I lost it from
sun.
Me. I see sun, or source of energy, CIS, in other words, C-I-S. So there we have cybernetics, which actually doesn't work out too badly in using the Shaver alphabet.
Well, it may not work too badly, but I don't understand what any of these things have to do with cybernetics. I mean, I wrote the thing.
Well,
I don't know
what is cybernetics, then?
Well, the word actually comes from a Greek root, which means steersman.
But cybernetics, actually, as it is used today, is a comprehension of the mind applied to mechanical function. In other words, mind function applied to a mechanical function in order to gain knowledge. Isn't that correct? I mean, would that be a proper explanation?
Yeah, it would be.
So therefore, that would be adequate. I think that Shaver's explanation would be adequate also.
Yeah, well, I mean, this sort of intrigues me, because when I try to decipher the word cybernetics in this alphabet, I got nothing that made sense to me. I got to see why to exist, energy, danger, seed, and so on. Now, this reminds me of something that has always intrigued me, is that when Shakespeare died, his tombstone was carved in a very puzzling fashion, with certain letters capitalized, certain letters not capitalized, one word broken up, spaces in between them. And everyone has, all down throughout the ages, is convinced that Shakespeare left a very important coded message in his tombstone. And there have been several attempts. And I think one man recently decoded it, that the tombstone really said, "I was really Marlowe," or something like that. And that the original script of Hamlet is buried in some Scottish castle. Now, S.G. Perlman, who was one of America's most famous humorists, once wrote one of the most brilliantly funny articles I ever read in the New Yorker, right after this man had tried to decipher Shakespeare's tombstone, and he went to Grant's tomb. And he decided there was some hidden cipher in Grant's tomb. And it said, the very mystifying message, Ulysses S. Grant is buried here. You know, and this, of course, to Perlman, they immediately suggested all sorts of coded possibilities. And he worked out a system very close to the man who had figured out that Shakespeare's tomb actually said, I was really Marlowe. And he worked out a system where he got that the inscription on Grant's tomb said, Robert E. Lee is really buried here. Now, this is an astounding conclusion and just as valid as the other one. And what I really want to point out is that when you look for something, you're going to find it, especially in cryptograms.
Absolutely, and I agree with you 100% there, Ben. I don't say this alphabet is a direct revelation to Shaver through thought records from a civilization which existed in pre-cataclysmic times. But I say the same thing you said. I say it's extremely interesting to work with. The Shaver mystery is an intriguing mystery in itself. There is a lot of information relating to the Shaver mystery, which is dangerous for people to pursue, in other words.
Darrow's would retaliate?
It is claimed that Darrow's have retaliated at times. It is also claimed that we have one great science fiction writer, a fellow by the name of L. Taylor Hansen, who, by the way, strangely enough, used to write for Amazing Stories. He became interested in the Shaver mystery. And L. Taylor Hansen disappeared while on a trip into the desert in California to relocate a large boar. There was some type of a boar which went down into the earth. And according to what can be still derived from this information, Hansen described this boar as having smooth, glazed sides. And I can't recall exactly if it was square or round. And L. Taylor Hansen went again to relocate it, and he was never heard from again.
But aren't there supposed to be certain methods of tempting Darrow's to show? I understood that if you're alone at night,
and you throw your shoe
on the floor and you shout, I don't believe in Darrow's, that a Darrow will appear. And also that if
you tried it?
No, I've never tried it. I mean, I'll tempt the FBI, but I won't tempt Darrow's. But I heard also that another way is that if you publicly state that there are no such things as Darrow's and you dare Darrow's to do anything to you, the Darrow's will get rid of you, but they'll do it in such a way that it looks like a normal accident.
Well, I wouldn't know, Ben. So far, I've been talking about Darrow's for quite a while, and I may have seen
You've never infuriated one.
And a little later in the program, I am carrying on my person an actual photograph
of a Darrow?
Of what is claimed to be a Darrow.
Tex Dumont has one.
This one here, I think even you will admit, has possibilities of being a being from a cavern.
Is this the same thing that Tex Dumont has?
I doubt it. I think this is the only one of its kind in existence. Is it, Augie?
Well, the only one of that type. But I also have home a drawing of a supposed Darrow.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite interesting.
Well, I think this photograph, as soon as we show Ben, I think that he will change his
mind. Well, there are a Darrow. Well, I mean, a Darrow is a type of microscopic worm. I mean, is that what you're referring
no,
to?
No. A Darrow derived the name from detrimental row, a detrimental robot. And actually, it was caused by this detrimental energy, this negative energy which began to emanate from the sun. So actually, tearing Darrow down into the Shaver alphabet, or not the Shaver alphabet, I should say the alphabet of the Titans, it would be known as man tongue. And using man tongue to derive the root meaning of Darrow, we would have to have detrimental energy, horror, source, would be the concept derived from man tongue.
Dominic, are you familiar with the science fiction classics of A.E. Van Vogt?
No, not particularly. I have read...
Particularly The World of Null A?
I recall reading it. I don't recall the story, the context itself. Really.
Well, one of the most brilliant concepts that Van Vogt created was something that sounds very familiar to, or very similar to this detrimental energy concept and these mechs. Only he had a different name for it. Was that this super civilization invented a type of mechanism called a distorter. And the distorter was something that could take over any machine and interfere with its functions. A distorter could transport people instantly through time-space. In fact, they used them as elevators. You know, you walked into an elevator on the ground floor and you were transported to the 24th floor. It wasn't a real elevator. It didn't go up and down through an elevator shaft. It just transported you through time and space. It could also transport you to the planet Venus, too. It also did certain things to people. It controlled their minds and all the rest of it. And this is a very brilliant science fiction concept. It was never claimed to be true, but it sounds like coming from the same general source.
Well, Shaver himself claimed that certain people were in rapport, or let's put it this way, in contact by ESP with Tiros, which are the good Deros, or in other words, integrative Ro. And he claimed that the works of Merit, and you have read Merit, the moon pool, the ship of Ishtar, and various...
I read the ship of Ishtar, yeah.
He claimed that Merit was in contact with Tiro, who resided in the caverns, and that many of his stories contain some of the basic truths of the ancients. Now, if we take in history and mythology, we have always a reference to the elders, the old ones. We have references to oracles, which, as a rule, resided in caverns or caves. It always seems that there's always a reference to the depths, the realms of darkness, as they are referred to. We have references to the inferno. We have references to the even today.
One of the early primitive Greek gods, Erechthonius, was supposed to have been born out of a hole in the ground.
Well, what was the source of calling the organized crime on the surface today the underworld? I mean, you see, we have these various references even to this day. And after all, I mean, Ben, there does seem to be, actually, as you read the Shaver mystery, proof upon proof seems to build up. Now, Shaver predicted, and I can't recall the exact event, I can't recall the exact particle. Shaver not only predicted, but he came out with concepts of gravitation. And he claimed that gravitation was actually a flow, an ether drift.
A what?
An ether drift.
I don't know what that means.
What he meant was that there are these particles which are dispersed, these minute particles, traveling at fantastic velocities, which have a tendency in some way to change from a pure waveform into a corpuscular form of matter, and by their friction of penetration through matter as we know it, create what we could term gravity. In other words, these particles are actually gravitational particles.
Are you seriously coming out with the view that the molecular wave theory is responsible for gravity?
Ben, how can you misconstrue my intentions? I am only stating what Shaver said. I am not in no way stating my own personal belief or opinions in gravitational theory
I would humbly submit that Shaver was well over his head in this.
Well, strangely enough, Ben, you find that Shaver predicted that in a short time a smaller particle of matter of a particular type would be found. I cannot recall the exact name he attributed to it. I cannot recall the exact way he said it would be found. But strangely enough, it happened, as Shaver said.
Oh, that's easy. I can do it. I'll do that right now. I predict that within the next 6 months, 2 new meson particles will be found, since they find one every 3 months.
Yeah, but you are Ben Iskowitz. You are a cybernetician. You work as a more or less a scientist. Shaver was not a cybernetician. He was not a scientist.
He was a welder.
He was a welder in a shipyard.
Yes, this is legit. He was a welder in a shipyard.
You see, then again, we have to take Shaver's position. We have to take his attitude, his type of person. Shaver was a from what I can gather, I never met the man personally. From what I could gather from
Has anyone ever seen Shaver?
Yes.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely, sir.
I'll tell you a couple of people that have met Shaver, to my knowledge. Curtis Fuller. The editor of Fate magazine, yes.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I remember that. During
in fact,
the coffee
he told
break,
us that, yes.
Yeah, during the coffee break, he brought that up, yeah.
Now, he told us that, Shaver, this may be news to you, Dominic, that Shaver was a pretty good writer, and he was a sports writer at one time, and eventually went into science fiction. Did you know that?
I knew that he was some form of writer, Jerry.
No.
But, I mean, just how good he was or how successful, I don't know.
Well, then why would a competent writer turn over to Palmer, scraps paper with little notations on the back of an envelope and things like that to write it?
Well, if, as you said before, John, that he was getting these, as I said, that he was getting the messages through the welding machine, and you came up with a very good point there, that if, as he was receiving these messages, he would have to use whatever he had on hand, and that would be to scribble these messages onto the backs of envelopes. Probably at the time, even while he was getting the messages, he wasn't attributing too much basic facts to him. He wasn't actually thinking about it too much. He was probably just packing these sheaves of scrap paper into envelopes and sending them into Palmer just for the sheer joy of it, more or less.
Now, of course, some time ago, you know, they published a book, I think it was entitled The Elder World. And that book was autographed by the author, Richard S. Shaver. Now, that should be of interest. So then you should know that there was actually a Shaver if he was autographing the book.
Oh, I know there was a Shaver, Jim.
It was Ben that was
questioning that. Now, they also, I remember him and Palmer put out a book called I Remember Lemuria and The Return of Sathanas, which was by Richard S. Shaver, but it is definitely Palmer's contribution which made it readable. And that was put out by Venture Books in 1948. So, actually, there was hardcover books published, but they were in limited quantities. And, actually, I don't think that Shaver today is doing any writing, from what I can gather from Palmer.
What is he doing? Welding?
That I don't know, John. I know he lives in a very backwoods section of the country.
Which part of the country?
Where does he live in?
Wisconsin,
now? Wisconsin, yes.
Well, Palmer lives there, too.
Palmer lives in Wisconsin, yes.
Is there, in Amherst, is there a possibility, and I'm not trying to be facetious, but is there a possibility that maybe Palmer has Shaver working for him at the plant there? You know, he has a printing plant.
Gee, I don't know, John. I wouldn't know. I'll have to inquire of Palmer as to Shaver's particular occupation at this time. But I do know that one of the things, Ben, that seems to be the strongest point of the whole argument, as we might call our discussion, is the fact that a magazine that had boosted its circulation to 185,000 copies per month for a science fiction magazine, remember, just by including the Shaver mystery in it. Now, the contention is that pressure was put on this magazine.
Amazing Stories?
On Amazing Stories, by a group of science fiction writers led by a 17-year-old boy at the time. Now, actually, I don't think that was the excuse that was used. But I don't think that the circulation was increased to such a vast degree that I don't think the science fiction groups were the majority of buyers of the magazine any longer.
Do you mean to imply, Dominic, that a 17-year-old boy would carry so much weight that the publishers, Ziff Davis, would decide to discontinue the publishing of Shaver, of the Shaver mystery, when it boosted their circulation up to 185,000?
That's just what I was getting at, John. I don't think that a small minority group like that could cause a publisher to drop the magazine, or to drop the Shaver mystery, I should say. Because I know myself, I spoke to news dealers, and news dealers told me that as soon as the Shaver mystery was dropped from the magazine, that the magazines weren't moving off the shelves as they were previous to that.
Now, so what do you think?
Yeah, but what do you think?
Caused that to stop the...
You're implying something. I'm not implying, John. I'm just wondering. What is it? I'd like to know what. Because when I made that statement before about the FBI investigating Shaver, and Ben jumped on my neck there and he wouldn't let me finish.
I never jump. I proceed cautiously.
Cybernetically. And that what they told him, actually, this is Palmer's words, was one fact which made it difficult to drop the mystery. The same factor, and this is the other part of the sentence, convinced Shaver of the reality of flying saucers. The same factor, in other words, whatever these men told him, convinced Shaver of the reality of saucers. So, there is definitely, you said, you didn't commit yourself before when I asked you, Ben, do you think there is a silence group?
What do you mean? A silence group throttling people from talking about
Well, a silence group keeping certain
facts about
flying. Facts, not only what we call technology away from people, but keeping certain truths away from people.
Well, I think Major Kehoe is under this impression.
Well, Major Kehoe is under the impression that the a certain branch of the government itself
That's right.
is...
Oh, you're not referring to the government.
No, I'm not referring to the government. I say that there are forces on this planet which we know little of. I remember...
When you say forces, are you talking about human beings now?
I don't know, John. I just say some type of... We can call it metaphysical in concept. We can call it some type of a metaphysical force brought down to the level of a human being. I don't know, John. But I do remember one thing. During our investigation, that's Augie and myself, of the Bender mystery, I remember saying to Al Bender, I said to Bender, I said, is it possible that we are owned by someone or something? And he turned white. Didn't he, Augie?
That's
you recall that time?
Definitely.
That stopped him cold. I said, it is possible that we are owned by someone or something. That is quite a fantastic concept, that there would be forces which would withhold man from achieving what may be some type of cosmic heritage which he is entitled to.
You just lowered the temperature in this room about 20 degrees along the region of my spine.
Well, I'll tell you, I hope.
What was this? Towers? What happened?
Well, we're talking about the powers that be, John. There may be powers.
Silencing powers?
There may be powers that be which act in a very subtle manner, probably acting on some of the more principal forces of life in general, which are throttling the human mind to the degree where eventually it will destroy itself. I don't know.
Well, I hope that if they're going to do any silencing, that they don't start on me until I get through with a couple of pieces of business right now. And as some of his relatives have said, those who no longer want to be associated with the Lucchesi family, they claim that Dominic is possibly a direct descendant of the D. Rose. Benjamin Isquith, the cybernetician, gentleman who works on the 703, the 704, and also he works on the 650, and according to some of his friends, he should be in 701. That's that school, you know.
Yeah, I have just been used to that term.
We've had as engineers and really very competent engineers, that is on model railroads, not too good in radio, but you know. And of course, with those two gentlemen at the controls, if you've noticed any undue poor reception, if the quality has not been up to standards, you know the reason. You possibly haven't been listening to WOR. We possibly are tuned in to WMCA and you didn't know it, because these boys can really... Yes, they can. Russ, I understand that Mr. Stinklepore was over to Dr. Krasny's office recently, huh? Good, good. That's right. Well, Charlie Krasny, Dr. Krasny, who's practiced Flatbush, isn't he? I'm sorry.
Pete, without a doubt. I mean, I've heard more reports from listeners tell me that this man is absolutely fabulous as a chiropractor. Absolutely, and I'm happy to hear that Mrs. Pinkerpore is feeling better. Very, very good. Sweet German black cat strap elastic. Babies, we're going to have to wrap it up, unfortunately. I'll be back with you again tonight at midnight, and we'll be here with Charles Leadham, Cortland Hastings, Major Donnelly Kehoe, and Lady Belmont, and Sir Belmont. Good night, and happy pet shop. So if you're getting up, I sincerely hope you have a very, very pleasant day. Get a good night's sleep and sleep well.